We are living in an incredibly fast-paced world right now. Every day seems like an avalanche of headlines. But one thing that journalists sometimes fail to do is take a breath, go back, and give you a little context. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. And that is our mission, to go a little deeper, to look at President Trump's rhetoric on immigration and how that's playing out in people's lives in Texas. Talk to three mayors around the country to get different slices of what 100 days of a new administration feels like, and to think about how we live now in 2017. In today's show, we make a former FBI agent sit in a public park and sort through a bunch of Wi-Fi signals, the way you would. As always, come tell me and the team what you think at marketplace.org or on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We are starting this week with a look ahead to that milestone I just mentioned. April 29th will be President Trump's 100th day in office. The concept of evaluating a president after 100 days comes from Franklin Roosevelt, though he was actually referring to the first 100 days of the New Deal. Still, this time frame has become a pretty common metric when we look at how a new president's campaign promises meet the reality of governing. Here's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer on Wednesday talking up how the administration feels they've done.
There's a lot of executive orders that I think the president's been pleased with, not only what they've done or what they will do, but what they've done. I think when you look at immigration in particular, we see a very significant drop at the border. I think on jobs, there's been a lot of activity that we've been very proud to see American manufacturing and job creation.
So, okay, we have our own panel of experts to evaluate Trump's first 100 days. The mayors of Dalton, Georgia, Gillette, Wyoming, and Corvallis, Oregon. You know their voices. We've been talking to them for 2 years and spent the past few months reporting from their cities. Dennis Mock of Dalton, Georgia, Louise Carter King of Gillette, Wyoming, and Biff Traber of Corvallis, Oregon. We got them all on the line. Welcome back, you guys.
Thank you.
Glad to be back.
Good to talk to you.
It's nice to hear all of your voices. You know, my first question for all of you, really, and I guess, Louise, let's start with you. How do people in your cities feel about the first 100 days that President Trump has had in office?
Well, I think they still are feeling pretty good about it. Everyone is still optimistic. People here are pretty happy with some of his appointments to his cabinets. They felt that they were pretty pro-energy. And, of course, we are the energy capital
of the
nation.
That's what you produce. Yep.
So I think most people are still pretty happy with the president.
Oh, same here. Our industry's picking up. People are back at work, and the economy seems to be moving very well here. The whole general atmosphere here is pretty upbeat, so all is well here.
I know, Biff, that things are a little different in your neck of the woods.
Well, I was going to say they're very different here. I'd say energy fits into part of it. There's a trepidation waiting to understand what is really going to occur out of President Trump's promises. There's serious concern about impacts of climate change and immigration enforcement. But there's also energy, tremendous new energy motivating people to get involved in local government, get involved in politics. A lot of people have decided they really need to get involved to help deal with this.
One question I have, Dennis and Louise, for you, who are both in communities that have supported the president, how have they reacted, folks in your cities, to what we've seen as a series of kind of 180-degree turns on a lot of aspects of policy? So currency manipulation, NATO, supporting Janet Yellen, things like that. Do those resonate in your cities?
My answer in Dalton, Georgia is, well, a lot of folks feel like it's about time. You know, we've heard need for change for a long time, and, you know, we don't expect everything he promised to happen overnight and really happen at all, but at least make the effort to make some changes that we feel like we've needed for a long time.
So it doesn't bother you that, say, some of the things he campaigned on, it seems like, at least right now, he's not going to do?
Well, I think all of us as mayors could tell you we didn't get everything done, and we're not going to get everything done that we promised either.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Louise, how about you?
Well, I have not heard any complaints yet. You know, it has just been 100 days. And like I said before, a lot of things have happened that we've liked. You know, he's said that he probably won't go ahead with the Clean Power Plan. So I really haven't heard any complaints yet.
What do you all want to see in the second 100 days? You know, are there things that are particularly important to your constituents that you do or don't want to see?
This is Dennis in Dalton, Georgia. And one of the biggest issues we have right now, I think, to get us more on track would be to go ahead and start tackling immigration. They pretty well laid out the plan to us that, yeah, we're going to secure the borders and we're going to get rid of the criminal element of the illegal immigrants. But then what next is the next step? And I think once we get that resolved in Dalton, Georgia, that will really help the sentiment around here.
This is Biff, and I'd like to chime in on, I think, as you talk about immigration, the real thing we need is to take a step back and actually reform this system. We need, to me, sensible reform that builds on the work that many of these immigrants are doing, the taxes they do pay, and how we make sense out of it rather than simply get into this political battle back and forth over very simple messages.
Dennis, I want to follow up with you for a second, because you are in a city that is also 48% Latino. And I know that as a mayor, you have a delicate balance in terms of, you know, representing an area that voted for President Trump, but also has a very large Latino population. How's that been for you?
Actually, the Latino sentiment about Donald Trump is very much like everyone else's. They're all in favor of secure the borders. Let's get rid of the criminal element, and then let's get reform underway, and let's get it, like Biff said, a sensible approach. And they all want to get legalized, not necessarily naturalized, but they want to feel like they're comfortable here and legal here. Not enough was done, or anything was done, for so many years that they just felt like they were home free, and now it's in question again.
Are they scared?
To a certain extent, yes. You know, it's like they're almost immobilized in some instances. They're afraid to do anything because they don't know what the next step is. And we keep trying to put the message out there. If you stay away from doing anything wrong, you're going to be pretty much okay.
Luis, what would you like to see in the next 100 days? You know, some of your constituents said to me, we would love for coal to come back, but we're also very aware that natural gas may be a bigger worry than, say, environmental regulation.
Well, I think there's two or three things that we'd like to see here. Maybe a formalized plan to invest in clean coal research. I feel we're 8 years behind where we should be. With natural gas, we get that's just the natural market reactions is, you know, to the ebb and flow of the energy. But we feel we could do a lot with some more research here. Another thing that has concerned cities like ours, plus others in Wyoming and maybe in the other two mayor states, is the airports that Trump has talked about closing. That would kill so many cities like ours that we are hoping to show President Trump and his administration that we really do need that transportation. Also, his infrastructure spending, I hope that comes to fruition. And with also with the ports, we could use some more ports to ship our clean coal.
There is something that all three of you have in common besides being mayors. You have all, or currently do, run businesses. And I'm wondering, you know, the president has said government should run more like a business. Where are places that you think he can take good lessons from that? And then where are the places where you think, you know, there are some things I learned in office where government does not actually run like a business?
I mean, one of the things up front that if it's done methodically, which I'm concerned it may not be now, is to continue to look at staffing and staffing efficiencies. It's something we do here locally. We just went through 2 years of trying to take $1 million out of our internal operations as part of dealing with our local financial problems. Something like that, done without all of the PR and without zeroing out budgets, is the kind of thing I look at as an efficiency thing that comes from more of a business background that I think we can all benefit from.
Dennis?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with Biff. I mean, we're going to have to look at some efficiencies in government, and I really feel like President Trump is starting to do that with talking about cutting budgets of departments and making them live a little leaner, and or even in some cases a lot leaner, because I think there has been a lot of fluff in the federal government, and hopefully he sees that and can do something with that.
I think, as in business and as we've done in the city these last year and a half, where we've had to trim back, combining departments, we've found some efficiency doing that, where, you know, some were duplicating the services, so we have combined them, and that has saved us, you know, personnel plus, of course, revenue or funds. Trump has also talked about easing the permitting process for infrastructure projects, and I think that that's something that could help the government work a little more efficient. In real life or in real business, business can't wait that long. You've got to move at the speed of business, not government.
I think Louise hit the nail on the head. Deregulation is one of the things we're looking forward to, is freeing up a lot of the constraints of moving forward with business is going to be really important.
Well, I would. This is Biff. I'd just add one caution to remember 2007, 8, and 9, where the result of deregulation of one industry was the Great Recession in terms of phrasing, and we suffered through it, and not as badly as other parts of our state, but we need to be very cautious about how deregulating we're making things.
Biff Traber, Louise Carter King, and Dennis Mock, thank you very much.
Well, thank
You're
you,
welcome.
And have a good day, Mayor.
Thank you.
If you know Marketplace, you know we love our numbers. It's kind of our signature thing. So let's dig into some important ones with our producers Sarah Menendez and Tony Wagner as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Take it away, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
$867,000.
That's how much cash travelers left behind at airport security checkpoints last year.
New York's JFK Airport was the most generous with loose change. About $70,000 never made it to their final destinations.
Here's the kicker. The TSA gets to keep the money. So far, they've been putting it toward expanding the TSA PreCheck program.
No word yet on what they plan to do with your half-empty water bottles, though.
$736 million.
That's how much money Los Angeles County could lose in direct spending by foreign tourists over the next 3 years, according to the travel consultancy firm Tourism Economics.
Officials are worried that presidential politics and rhetoric might inspire a so-called Trump slump in the wake of 6 years of straight tourism growth.
To combat the potential decline, LA Tourism Board launched an ad campaign with the message, "Everyone is welcome."
Half a billion hours.
That's how long people have spent watching Adam Sandler's movies on Netflix, according to announcement this week by the streaming site.
Netflix bought the exclusive rights to 4 Adam Sandler movies in 2014 and just re-upped for another 4 films in March.
Sandler has long been a box office champion, but his latest films haven't performed as well in theaters or with critics.
And his 2015 Netflix venture, The Ridiculous Six, scored 0% on Rotten Tomatoes.
To be fair, it's hard to top click.
My team and I spend a lot of time reporting on the road. That means countless hours in airports, hotels, and unfamiliar public places. And every time I open up my laptop to do some work or log into an app on my phone, I wonder, is this safe? If you've ever navigated the world of public Wi-Fi, you know this stuff is really confusing. And now that it's legal for internet service providers to sell your data, it's even more important to make sure you're keeping things as private as you want them to be. To explore this issue, we took a short trip out of the office into Bryant Park in Manhattan, a beautiful outdoor space that's popular for reading and working outside. It's right next to the New York Public Library, and it has a cafe and lots of Wi-Fi networks. We met up with Ed Stroes, the founder and co-president of the cybersecurity firm Stroes Friedberg. I'm going to let him describe himself.
I've been doing this for over 20 years, starting with my time in the FBI here in New York, where I formed and supervised the first computer crime squad for the New York office. and have been able to see the field evolve. And you'll decide whether you trust me, but I consider myself trustworthy.
Well, I'm going to attempt to turn on my Marketplace laptop. It's going to be a little grumpy at me for a while. You know what my password is?
No, I looked over
you didn't
there
look?
Because I'm
okay.
Trustworthy. That's trust in action.
That is serious trust in action. Okay, so here we are. We are outside the New York Public Library. We're in Bryant Park. Let's see what we got.
So we're seeing here more than even fits in this little window. I bet if we scroll down, it goes for a ways just to... Oh, yeah, you can see.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's dozens, it looks like, without counting them. But, I mean, you can just see there are names like ASCOM, Gainer, ATT Wi-Fi.
Ondas Wi-Fi. I'm going to guess that that's the hotel across the street.
Well, here's one of the key things, which is all we know is that these Wi-Fi networks are named this by somebody. We don't know whether that name is an actual accurate representation of the owner of that wireless router.
So that very well might not be the hotel across the street. And I'm going to guess that ATT Wi-Fi is... What is that?
Well, I mean, AT&T could be having a... Because this is such a popular spot here, that they would want to encourage their customers to use their service. And so they'll put a hotspot in this area if you're an AT&T customer. I think the important thing is when you see a list like this, that you don't take it as a guarantee that the name you're interpreting on the screen is exactly what you think it is.
Well, here's this, NYPL. We're in front of the New York Public Library.
You would think that that's it, but we don't know. And if I were going to use that network, I think what I would do is I'd go into the library and I'd say, are you running a wireless network for people to use? And if they say yes, you say, can you tell me what the name of it is? Because if I wanted to do something nefarious, I could set up a wireless network here, call it New York PL or something like that, and people could look at it and say, hey, here's the public library.
Are there people, hackers or, you know, just criminals who do this?
Oh, yes.
You look at me like I'm a moron. Like, yeah, of course.
No, it's a fair question. Not just hackers, but also there are nation-state intelligence officers that are in this field. And there is so much information and data pouring off of us. You hear the term sometimes data exhaust. It's just as you go through life, you're spewing it out, and you need to make connections to do work. The people are thinking, well, if I'm interested in that, in making a connection with that person or getting your data, there are so many opportunities for me to do that when you're looking for connectivity in a public area. Anybody who's watched spy movies knows these are good places to have a rendezvous.
What do you do if you're in, say, a hotel or an airport or a mall and you want to get online? What's a safe way to use them?
When you boot up and go online, there are things that you can do by minimizing the kind of activities that you do. Like if you don't have to do online banking through a wireless connection, even though it might be secure the way you're doing it, if you don't need to, I wouldn't. And secondly, there are technologies like a virtual private network, or a VPN it's called. And by using those facilities, you create, in effect, an encrypted tunnel between your device and the servers that you're connecting to. It gives you privacy, more security, and they've really, I think, made the technologies pretty simple to use.
And how about at home? If I want to get online at home and I want to go on my Wi-Fi, my neighbor's Wi-Fi, do you think it's worth, say, having a VPN at home?
Sure. It's worth it because it's easy to do, and it'll give you more privacy. So I've heard people say that they don't even want their internet service provider having access to their browser history. Now, other people don't care. But if you do, and you want to make sure that that's not accessible, a VPN is probably going to make it impossible for them to see that. You have to give thought to your life and what we call cyber resilience. There's no cyber proof. It's just how resilient do you want to be? How much inconvenience can you take?
When we think not just about individuals, but about organizations, businesses, whomever, whose ultimate responsibility is it to ensure safety, if we want to use that word?
I think there are two parties. The party that is using the technology always has an obligation because you can't overcome sloppy behavior on one person's part by trying to get somebody else to fix it. So it's always an individual consumer level to some degree. But I think the out-of-the-box service providers and carriers have a certain obligation. And we've always seen that. We expected people that made cars as we learn more, to put headrests in, to avoid whiplash, to put seatbelts in. I think there are certain baseline things that either have to be standard or available so that you can invoke them. And I don't think we've gotten the balance very well so far. People will say, well, you know, I want to sign up, I want to get the service. And they think of it as a utility, a little bit like plugging a device in an electrical socket. You know, I want that. I want to be connected to the internet. And you have to be more sophisticated in your thinking than this. You have to realize it's not like an electrical outlet. You're providing information that a service provider has access to, has to be able to access in order to run the network. The question is, what do they do with the information?
And now we're in an environment in which the regulatory mechanisms are saying, actually, you can sell that information.
That's right. And if that is considered reasonable, I mean, our legal system is a good place to go to say, well, what's reasonable? And our case law has shown that over time, in evolving through a lot of cases, you get a better answer. This technology is so new that the track record of litigation isn't as rich as it is in other areas. So we don't have the same sort of case law foundation. So I think it's mostly a legal issue. And then the technology has to reflect what the legal standards are for reasonableness. And it's just not that evolved right now.
When I think about other things, you know, we as consumers do. So let's say you drive a car, right? You have car insurance. You buy car insurance. Do you think it's possible we could evolve to a world where consumers are footing the bill for an extra layer of paid-for protection?
I think if you have to pay for some extra protection, I think that's probably a good analogy, because you do when you buy a car and you can check how much insurance you actually want to have. I could see that happening. For example, we talked about VPNs.
Yeah.
Maybe that should be something that is embedded within the package that you get instead of having to be an add-on. People use routers to be able to go to the dark web that are differently configured. And if those have costs to them, and if you have to pay for it, then I think it'll come down to whoever's getting the benefit will have to pay for it. If it's free, as they say, very often the value that you're giving up is the information that goes with the service you got for free. Don't just think about it in terms of what happens to you. Think about what happens when your technology is compromised and aimed at somebody else. You have to get away from, I think, this sort of digital narcissism and just think about ourselves and think about that we are part of an ecosystem, and that network means that there are certain standards of behavior we should all respect.
Ed Stroz, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
On the show, you heard from mayors of three cities around the country. One of those cities, Corvallis, Oregon, designates itself as a sanctuary city. And there's no formal definition of what that term means, but basically, in a sanctuary city, local law enforcement might stop or arrest someone who is in the country illegally for a minor crime, but not turn them over to federal immigration authorities, hence providing sanctuary. It's obviously a very contentious issue, and we're going to focus on one fight over the policy now. In Travis County, Texas, that's where the city of Austin is, and it tends to be a blue dot in a red state. Marketplace's Andy Euler is there, and he joins me. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Lizzie.
So this current policy fight actually began with a campaign promise from the new sheriff in town in Travis County, Sally Hernandez. What did she promise?
She told people when she was campaigning to be sheriff that her policy was to focus on local public priorities and leave it to the federal immigration officials to focus on federal immigration enforcement. So essentially saying, we're going to focus on Travis County, we're going to focus on Austin, and make sure that we're not getting in the way of what ICE is doing, but also we're not going to hold undocumented immigrants in county jails so that ICE can detain them. It's not that necessarily Hernandez is saying we're going to specifically not help ICE. It's just that we're not going to go out of our way to help them out.
Mm. This campaign promise sort of became policy February 1st of this year, and it does set up a conflict with the federal government. What effects are you seeing on the ground?
When you go out into Austin, when you go into neighborhoods that are predominantly Hispanic, what people are telling me is that they're afraid to leave the house. They're still afraid to go to work. And these raids that ICE officials kind of enacted were in February. So it's been a little while. But what everybody is telling me right now is that they're still afraid to leave the house to go and be a member of commerce, basically, in Austin, Texas. I went into a laundromat in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood, and I talked to a woman who's the manager there, Marta Soto, and she told me basically what their business is dealing with right now.
This business is only waiting. Since they don't want to come in the morning, they can come at night so we can stay open because we have to do business with them. Those who want to use the machines but that don't come in the day because they don't want to be surprised about not being able to return home. And they're still like this.
Her business has completely changed. People are coming and washing their clothes at night, and I went during the day, and she's right. It was basically empty. So these businesses are sort of feeling the effect of this policy.
Wow. Hernandez's policy has run smack up against the wishes, and I guess we could say the ire, of Texas's governor, Greg Abbott. And he's, you know, withholding some money from Travis County. What happened there?
Yeah, the governor pretty immediately said, if you're going to act as a sanctuary city, if you're going to enact policies like Sheriff Hernandez did for Travis County, we're going to take money that we have allocated to you away. It's about $1.5 million to Travis County. I went and talked to a county judge, and what I heard was it's not actually going to be money that would be used for immigration. It's stuff that would be used for social safety net things. But it's one of those things where the state can say, look, if you don't change your policy and adhere to what we think you should be doing, we're going to take money away. Sarah Eckhart is the county judge that I spoke with, and we talked about what the funding means for the county and what it means for local law enforcement, sort of what it means for all of these different programs. And she said they're trying to figure it out right now and figuring out a priority list of what they can cut if they have to.
Without this grant money, we will see layoffs at the county. We will see a pulling back from these innovative programs that keep people out of jail. We'll see a pulling back from some of the good work that we've done in disaster preparedness that we do, frankly, on behalf of the state. We're an arm of the state, and when the state cuts off our arms, we are less capable of doing their work for them.
Andy, is there potential for Travis County to lose federal money as well as state money?
About $52 million.
Wow.
That's how much money Travis County gets from the feds in essentially block grants. And so this is what's one thing that Judge Eckhart and I were talking about, is they're having a meeting in May to discuss if this goes to that extreme, if it's not just $1.5 million from the state, if it's $52 million from the feds, these are the things we're going to have to cut. And that's a lot of money. And if you're developing a budget at the municipal level, you're either going to cut a ton of things or you're going to increase taxes for the people of Travis County. That's a big part of it.
So all of the sides right now are refusing to budge from their positions. If you look a little bit down the line, past some of the funding stuff, what does this mean for the people who live in Travis County without legal documentation?
There's talk of a state bill, SB 4, right now, which would define and make illegal any sort of sanctuary city status. Mm. And so what it would do would make it illegal for Sheriff Hernandez to have this policy. And so at the state level, they're trying to formalize what it means to be a sanctuary city, what these policies mean. And they're trying to formalize how you would be out of line with the state. But for people who live here, for these immigrants, it's a waiting game. And it's not only undocumented people either. I talk to a lot of people who have their paperwork in order, who have visas and who have green cards, who say, we're even scared because we don't necessarily know if we're just going to be hanging out with people who happen to be undocumented. If I work with somebody who's undocumented and then I get accused and I get taken to jail and I get held in a cell, people here are just genuinely afraid of what the federal ICE officials are going to do and what it implies about their everyday life, going to work, picking their kids up from school, going grocery shopping. I mean, these things are changing here in Travis County, and it doesn't seem like there's a whole lot of optimism about the future for these residents here.
That's Marketplace's Andy Euler reporting from member station KUT in Austin. And you can hear more of Andy's work on sanctuary cities all across Marketplace next week. Thank you, Andy.
No, thank you, Lizzie.
One thing we like to do on this show is ask people in the spotlight some questions about work, money, and the lessons they've learned along the way. It's called the Marketplace Quiz. Here's producer Haley Hirschman with this week's guest.
Hi, this is Tae Shi. I'm a musician, I'm a singer, a songwriter.
In a next life, what would your career be?
I think I would probably want to do something with my hands, like build or create something, whether it's art or just kind of, you know, building things, because I spend so much time making things that are intangible. And so I think I like the idea of being able to create things. So maybe a sculptor or something like that.
Yeah. Do you have any hobbies or downtime where you get to actually do that?
I don't actually. And I think that's probably why it appeals to me. Seeing something from start to finish really physically is interesting to me, and maybe now a hobby that I should take up.
What is the hardest part about your job that nobody knows?
The fact that you have to kind of be a million different things, I think, as a musician or as an artist nowadays, aside from, you know, making the music or being creative and inspired and, like, creating material, you kind of have to also be, you know, really on top of, like, the business side of things, especially if you're coming from an independent place and you do things yourself a lot. You have to also kind of be able to be a performer and create like a live show experience and be able to communicate with other musicians and really like be charismatic and be comfortable on stage. And then you also, you know, have to be able to put yourself out there and be like on social media and, you know, have like a persona and be relatable. And I think there's a lot of different things that maybe you used to be able to get away with not being, maybe when you could kind of be just a recording artist or just a touring artist or something. But I think now that, you know, we've transitioned into like the digital age and like everybody is so easily accessible and people kind of want to know everything about somebody, I think now you kind of have to be super well-rounded and like have many dimensions to you.
That sounds stressful.
It can be, but I think it can also be really rewarding, and it's a really cool opportunity to create something that has different dimensions and has depth to it, and kind of forces you to present yourself as more than just your music.
What is your most prized possession?
I have some pieces of things that belong to my grandmothers, and my grandmother on my dad's side, she spent a lot of time, actually, funny, kind of coming full circle, in her later years, like, making things with her hands. So she did a lot of, like, arts and crafts, and she did ceramics and stuff, and she made this one ceramic. She's just kind of like a young girl, and it's really lovely because you can, like, see, you know, all the indentations of, like, her hands and her fingers, like, making it, and that's one of the things that I have. But I have a lot of kind of little things like that that she made in her later years.
What advice do you wish someone gave you before you started your career?
I wish that somebody had really encouraged me to, like, trust my gut instinct in terms of the things that you want to do and the things you say yes to or the things that you take on.
Do you think that you do that now?
I think I've gotten better at doing it. I think it takes a certain amount of confidence and self-assuredness that I think, for me, it's definitely been a learning experience of getting more comfortable with being the voice of authority in things. And so that has come along with that process for me.
Tae Shi's album Crawl Space is out now. I want you to imagine that on Monday, you will carefully select an outfit, rehearse a few questions and answers in your mind, breathe deep, and walk into a job interview. And if you were to ask Jason Dana about it, he'd probably say it's not the greatest use of your time. He is an assistant professor of management and marketing at Yale, and he recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times called "The Utter Uselessness of Job Interviews." And okay, that's a grabby headline. But I asked him to explain why he thinks job interviews are not a great predictor of how we'll do at a job.
The problem is that people allow themselves too much freedom in constructing a narrative. And what we found in our studies that the Times piece was about was that people can construct narratives even out of complete nonsense. We had actually trained interviews to respond to questions on a pseudo-random basis. So their answers meant nothing. They were just about themselves anyway. They were just answering randomly. And we found that this didn't perturb people's ability to make narratives. So when they never discovered that they were doing in a random interview, they made predictions just as confidently as they made after accurate interviews. And they even said in rating scales that they agreed that they had gotten to know the person and that they had gotten useful information from the interview at a slightly higher rate than they did when they were answering after accurate interviews, right?
So how should a company then think about its hiring process? You know, what's a better option?
You know, that's a great question, and I get lots of emails about it. And the thing that's hard to answer about this question is that this is, of course, going to depend a great deal on your industry. So in some industries, we can get down to brass tacks very quickly about what your particular skills are and whether they are appropriate to the position you're applying to. So, I mean, I guess if you're a software coder, right, I can ask you about what kind of projects you implemented, what your role in them was. Can you give me examples of code? Maybe in some other fields it's a little harder, but you had asked what can employers do better.
Yeah.
One thing I would think is discipline in the interview process. So myself, I'm asked to interview people all the time. We have prospective PhD students or job applicants, and I'm asked to talk with people in any manner I want with no guidelines and then come back and render opinions. But I feel the seductive pull. You know, maybe someone makes an offhand comment during the interview and I want to make a narrative out of it and I want to use that narrative. But rationally, I know that this offhand comment may have little or no predictive validity, right? You know, one thing right off is I think you need clear goals before you enter into the interview. What are you looking for and what are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah. We've been doing a lot of work on this show and across Marketplace in general looking at automation and sort of the role of robots in the workforce. And in some ways, it seems counterintuitive that interviews would be less important. I mean, wouldn't they be more important if you're looking at, say, well, yeah, but robot's going to handle the packing and the shipping. I want to make sure that Sharon in sales can have a human conversation.
Yeah, that's a great point. And probably the number one objection that I hear is, well, what I'm really trying to find out is whether I'm going to like the person, whether there's going to be a good organizational fit, et cetera. And I'm certainly sensitive to that. The thing is, what makes you think that you can figure out who you're going to get along with and who's going to fit from a brief conversation in a very unusual context, which is the job interview?
Do you imagine a future, say 5 or 10 years down the road, where, you know, high school students or college students aren't even taught about job interviews and interview protocol anymore?
I don't, but that's just a guess. Okay. Just based on the comments on the article and some of the emails I've gotten, people still believe very strongly in the ability of the interview to do something, even if it's just figure out who you might like to work with or whether someone's going to fit. And as a result, I think smart high school and college students are actually availing themselves of interview training. Hmm. Right? So they're learning how to take interviews, what kind of questions people like to ask, everything down to sometimes the handshake to begin. And that concerns me because in that sense, maybe an interview can be kind of gamified. So in other words, maybe what you've learned from the interview is just how good of an interviewee they are, which presumably doesn't connect much to job success, if that's all they've done is sort of drilled to be a good interviewee.
Jason Dana, Assistant Professor of Management and Marketing at Yale, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
We put Jason Dana's Central Point online to see what people thought. Are job interviews a waste of time? Here are your responses, read by a few people from the Marketplace staff.
Interviews are not, but online applications that make you type in your resume that you also just uploaded are a huge waste of time.
As much as the interviewer thinks he's interviewing me, I'm doing the same. I wouldn't walk into a job sight unseen or without information.
An interview that doesn't explore team dynamic is a waste of time.
Interviews are not a waste. Sending a resume is, though. I've gotten most of my work via networking, not applying.
Do all marriages turn out for the best? No. But that doesn't mean dates are a waste of time. Neither are job interviews.
I'm always amazed by the number of young people who show up for interviews wearing jeans. I work in a nice retail department store, so at least put on a decent pair of dress slacks.
from Twitter. That was at Uncle Struggles, at Bombay Soprano 1, at Math Dr. Quinn, and at Alana Sofko. And from Facebook, Linda Harlow. From what to wear to what to say, this stuff is hard. And even though job interviews might involve narratives that aren't always true, well, they're still how companies do business. If you are curious about the world of work and its sometimes confusing culture, you may have come across our next guest's blog. Her name is Allison Green, and the site is called Ask a Manager. It covers basically everything you'd want to ask one of your higher-ups, if only you could. Allison, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
What to you is the utility of a job interview?
As a hiring manager with limited time to evaluate candidates, they are the best way that we have figured out to do it. I think sometimes people think, why can't you just look at my resume and my cover letter and that gives you an idea of my experience? The thing is, it doesn't as much as job seekers sometimes think it does. I have repeatedly had the experience of seeing a resume that looked perfect, someone whose experience and skills seemed to be exactly the match for what I needed, and then getting into the interview and discovering they weren't such a strong match after all. And I think it's because resumes don't tell the full story. You know, people embellish or they don't actually know how to represent their experience well in writing, so they actually didn't come across as strong as they really are. Or a resume might make someone's role in a project sound different than what it actually was. And when you start digging into it, you discover they weren't really leading this project or they weren't really playing a key role in it. And they also don't really tell you about how people think. I mean, you have to talk to someone and have a back and forth and probe into why they made certain decisions or why they approached something that way in order to really understand how someone operates. And interviews so far are the best way we've found to figure out how to do that.
You've been doing this for a while and writing about it for a while. And I wonder, have best practices changed as sort of the nature of work has changed over the past decade or so? Or are they still, you know, are there still common themes that you think are relevant and were relevant in 1990?
I think some things have changed and some things have stayed very much the same. One trend that I've seen a lot of just in like the last 4 or 5 years is increasingly employers are relying not just on the interview conversation itself, but on finding ways during the interview process of really seeing people in action. So it could be giving a mini work assignment or having them do a role play or some kind of exercise or something that lets you actually see them doing the work or a rough simulation of the work. And that's new. I don't think you saw a lot of that 10 years ago.
I have a couple of questions that our listeners sent in or tweeted to us. And there was one, I think, that speaks to sort of this economic moment in time. This is from Jeff, who said, if one, okay, me, has been involuntarily out of a career field for years, recession, then couldn't get rehired, what are some tips to help?
It's tough. I think the best thing you can do is to put yourself in the shoes of that hiring manager and think, if you were looking at yourself as a candidate, what's the evidence that you would look at that you could excel in this job? So maybe there's some sort of transferable experience from your past, or maybe there's some skill or even a personality trait that would make you really well suited for the work, and extract that stuff and paint a picture for them, make it really easy for them to connect all of those dots. If you're relying on them to figure out on their own why you would be good at it, they're likely to go with a candidate where it's more superficially obvious why the person would be good.
What about for recent grads? You know, this is the season where people who are getting out of school are thinking about the world of work. Are there kind of secret things that you've learned that they should know, particularly young people?
Sometimes people who are less experienced at interviewing, and frankly, even people who are more experienced, just kind of wing it and hope that it goes well. But you will do such a better interview if you put real time and effort into preparing ahead of time. So reflect on what the job takes to perform it well, reflect on what experiences or skills you can point to that illustrate that you'll excel at those things, and really come up with specific examples of times that you've used those skills successfully in the past. And the other thing I think I would add about preparing for an interview is most people have an interview question that they dread being asked, something that they hope isn't going to come up, whether it's salary or why they left their last job. It's so much better to figure out what the thing is that you're worried about so that you can figure out an answer and practice delivering it in a way that you're comfortable with.
Is it okay to bring up salary and salary expectations in an interview?
This is so tricky. Most of us work for money and we're interested in knowing what a job will pay, but there is very much this mythology that candidates should only be interested in the work itself and that it's somehow crass to ask about money. This is obviously quite silly. But it is a mindset that's out there. So it is important to realize that some people do still buy into that way of thinking, and you do take a risk if you ask about salary during an interview. I do think it's changing, and I do think people are becoming more reasonable and realistic about this. And I also think it's safer to ask about salary later in the process, if it's turning into multiple interviews, or if you're being asked to fly out somewhere for an interview, if you're being asked to invest serious time or even money in taking part in the interview process, it becomes more understandable.
Allison Green runs the blog Ask a Manager. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Next week, we're talking with BuzzFeed's Dori Shafrir about her debut novel, Startup, a pretty deft skewering of the tech scene and its unsavory side.
Startup culture feels very male, very macho to me. It's kind of imbued with this sense of, well, we're doing things for the good of the world, which I think sometimes serves as a cover for bad behavior.
That's next time on Marketplace Weekend. And that's our show for this week. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Eliza Mills, Dan Semitovich, and Joanne Griffith. Brian Allison is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. We bid a fond farewell to Dan this week, which is his last as our senior producer. He's been our fearless leader from the beginning, and we will miss him almost as much as his references to obscure 80s pop culture. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.